Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 12, Chapter 4. It is natural for us, who are not living in those days, to imagine that when half Russia had been conquered, and the inhabitants were fleeing to distant provinces, and one levy after another was being raised for the defence of the fatherland, all Russians, from the greatest to the least, were solely engaged in sacrificing themselves, saving their fatherland, or weeping over its downfall. The tales and descriptions of that time, without exception, speak only of the self-sacrifice, patriotic devotion, despair, grief, and the heroism of the Russians. But it was not really so. It appears so to us because we see only the general historic interest of that time and do not see all the personal human interests that people had. Yet in reality, those personal interests of the moment so much transcend the general interests that they always prevent the public interest from being felt or even noticed. Most of the people at that time paid no attention to the general progress of events but were guided only by their private interests, and they were the very people whose activities at that period were most useful. Those who tried to understand the general course of events and to take part in it by self-sacrifice and heroism were the most useless members of society. They saw everything upside down, and all they did for the common good turned out to be useless and foolish. Like Pierre's and Mamonov's regiments, which looted Russian villages, and the lint the young ladies prepared, and that never reached the wounded, and so on. Even those fond of intellectual talk and of expressing their feelings who discussed Russia's position at the time involuntarily introduced into their conversation either a shade of pretense or falsehood, or useless condemnation and anger directed against people accused of actions no one could possibly be guilty of. In historic events, the rule forbidding us to eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge is especially applicable. Only unconscious action bears fruit, and he who plays a part in an historic event never understands its significance. If he tries to realize it, his efforts are fruitless. The more closely a man was engaged in the events then taking place in Russia, the less did he realize their significance. In Petersburg and in the provinces at a distance from Moscow, ladies and gentlemen in militia uniforms wept for Russia and its ancient capital and talked of self-sacrifice and so on. But in the army, which retired beyond Moscow, there was little talk or thought of Moscow. And when they caught sight of its burnt ruins, no one swore to be avenged of the French, but they thought about the terms, pay, their next quarters, of Matryoshka, the vivandiary, and like matters. As the war had caught him in the service, Nicholas Rostov took a close and prolonged part in the defence of his country, but did so casually, without any aim at self-sacrifice, and he therefore looked at what was going on in Russia without despair and without dismally racking his brains over it. Had he been asked what he thought of the state of Russia, he would have said that it was not his business to think about it, that Kutuzov and others were there for that purpose, but that he had heard that the regiments were to be made up to their full strength, that fighting would probably go on for a long time yet, and that things being so, it was quite likely he might be in command of a regiment in a couple of years' time. As he looked at the matter in this way, he learnt that he was being sent to Voronezh to buy remounts for his division, not only without regret at being prevented from taking part in the coming battle, but with the greatest pleasure, which he did not conceal, and which his comrades fully understood. A few days before the Battle of Borodino, Nicholas received the necessary money and warrants, and having sent some hussars on in advance, he set out with post horses for Voronezh. Only a man who has experienced it, that is, has passed some months continuously in an atmosphere of campaigning and war, can understand the delight Nicholas felt when he escaped from the region covered by the army's foraging operations, provision trains, and hospitals. When, free from soldiers' wagons and the filthy traces of a camp, he saw villages with peasants and peasant women, gentlemen's country houses, fields where cattle were grazing, post houses with station masters asleep in them, he rejoiced as though seeing all this for the first time. What for a long while specially surprised and delighted him were the women, young and healthy, without a dozen officers making up to each of them. Women, too, who were pleased and flattered that a passing officer should joke with them. In the highest spirits, Nicholas arrived at night at a hotel in Varennes, ordered things he had long been deprived of in camp, and next day, very clean-shaven and in full dress uniform he had not worn for a long time, went to present himself to the authorities. The commander of the militia was a civilian general, an old man who was evidently pleased with his military designation and rank. He received Nicholas brusquely, imagining this to be characteristically military, and questioned him with an important air, as if considering the general progress of affairs and approving and disapproving with full right to do so. Nicholas was in such good spirits that this merely amused him. From the commander of the militia he drove to the governor. The governor was a brisk little man, very simple and affable. He indicated the stud farms at which Nicholas might produce horses, recommended to him a horse dealer in the town and a landowner 14 miles out of town who had the best horses, and promised to assist him in every way. "You are Count Ilya Rostov's son. My wife was a great friend of your mother's. We are at home on Thursdays. Today is Thursday, so please come and see us quite informally," said the governor, taking leave of him. Immediately on leaving the governor's, Nicholas hired post horses and, taking his squadron quartermaster with him, drove at a gallop to the landowner, 14 miles away, who had a stud. Everything seemed to him pleasant and easy during that first part of this stay in Varennes, and as usually happens when a man is in a pleasant state of mind, everything went well and easily. The landowner, to whom Nicholas went as a bachelor, an old cavalry man, a horse fancier, a sportsman, and the possessor of some century-old brandy and some old Hungarian wine, who had a snuggery where he smoked, and who owned some splendid horses. In very few words, Nicholas bought 17 picked stallions for 6,000 rubles, to serve, as he said, as samples of his remounts. After dining, and taking rather too much of the Hungarian wine, Nicholas, having exchanged kisses with the landowner, with whom he was already on the friendliest terms, galloped back over abominable roads in the brightest frame of mind, continually urging on the driver so as to be in time for the governor's party. When he had changed, poured water over his head, and scented himself, Nicholas arrived at the governor's rather late, but with the phrase "better late than never" on his lips. It was not a ball, nor had dancing been announced, but everyone knew that Catherine Petrovna would play valses and the écossaise on the clavichord, and that there would be dancing, and so everyone had come as to a ball. Provincial life in 1812 went on very much as usual, but with this difference, that it was livelier in the towns in consequence of the arrival of many wealthy families from Moscow, and as in everything that went on in Russia at that time, a special recklessness was noticeable, an in for a penny, in for a pound, who cares spirit, and the inevitable small talk, instead of turning on the weather and mutual acquaintances, now turned on Moscow, the army, and Napoleon. The society gathered together at the governor's was the best in Vorenz. There were a great many ladies and some of Nicholas's Moscow acquaintances, but there were no men who could at all vie with the cavalier of St. George, the hussar remount officer, the good-natured and well-bred Count Rostov. Among the men was an Italian prisoner, an officer of the French army, and Nicholas felt that the presence of that prisoner enhanced his own importance as a Russian hero. The Italian was, as it were, a war trophy. Nicholas felt this. It seemed to him that everyone regarded the Italian in the same light, and he treated him cordially, though with dignity and restraint. As soon as Nicholas entered in his hussar uniform, diffusing around him a fragrance of perfume and wine, and uttered the words "better late than never," and heard them repeated several times by others, people clustered around him, all eyes turned on him, and he felt at once that he had entered into his proper position in the province, that of a universal favourite, a very pleasant position, and intoxicatingly so after his long privations. At post stations, at inns, and in the landowner's snuggery, maidservants had been flattered by his notice, and here too at the governor's party there were, as it seemed to Nicholas, an inexhaustible number of pretty young women, married and unmarried, impatiently awaiting his notice. The women and girls flirted with him, and from the first day the old people concerned themselves to get this fine young daredevil of a hussar married and settled down. Among these was the governor's wife herself, who welcomed Rostov as a near relative and called him Nicholas. Catherine Petrovna did actually play valses and the écossaise, and dancing began, in which Nicholas still further captivated the provincial society by his agility. His particularly free manner of dancing even surprised them all. Nicholas was himself rather surprised at the way he danced that evening. He had never danced like that in Moscow, and would even have considered such a very free and easy manner improper and in bad form, but here he felt it incumbent on him to astonish them all by something unusual, something they would have to accept as the regular thing in the capital, though new to them in the provinces. All the evening Nicholas paid attention to a blue-eyed, plump and pleasing little blonde, the wife of one of the provincial officials. With the naive conviction of young men in a merry mood that other men's wives were created for them, Rostov did not leave the lady's side and treated her husband in a friendly and conspiratorial style, as if, without speaking of it, they knew how capitally Nicholas and the lady would get on together. The husband, however, did not seem to share that conviction and tried to behave morosely with Rostov. But the latter's good-natured naivety was so boundless that sometimes even he involuntarily yielded to Nicholas's good humour. Towards the end of the evening, however, as the wife's face grew more flushed and animated, the husband's became more and more melancholy and solemn, as though there were but a given amount of animation between them, and as the wife's share increased, the husband's diminished. All right, there we go, another chapter down, hanging out with young Nikolai again, and it seems like Nikolai has become quite the ladies' man. Ladies? Ladies' man. He's been sent away from the battlefields and the thick of it to a provincial town to get some remounts for the army. Remounts, I'm pretty sure that just means horses, to get more horses. And he's loving it. He's loving this little assignment away from the army, just happy to be in a nice little town. He's all spruced up in his hussar's uniform, and ladies everywhere are taking notice of him. One thing I liked about this chapter was at the start talking about how during a big war or a big historical moment, something of great importance, still people mostly just focus on things that are important to them rather than the big important thing to everyone. The line was, "It appears so to us because We see only the general historic interest of that time and do not see all the personal human interests that people had, yet in reality those personal interests of the moment so much transcend the general interests that they always prevent the public interest from being felt or even noticed. And it made me think that that's probably what would happen, you know, even if a big war was declared and we were all swept up in some huge event, we'd all be aware of it, and it would be what most conversations would be about, but day to day we'd still just be swept up in our own personal things more than anything else. It's true, I think. I didn't really think about that, but once I read that chapter I realized how true that was. Tolstoy then goes on to, in a way, say that the people that engaged with the general importance, the thing that's generally important, became the most useless members of society in regard to that matter of importance. And the people that were actually most useful in regard to that matter of importance were the ones that sort of ignored it and went about their lives. Interesting take on it. And I suppose that's exactly what Nikolai is doing here, is disengaging from all the political stuff and the war and just doing what he wants to do, which is flirt with women. Turtle Vader said, Tolstoy speaks more directly to the reader in this chapter, speaking on behalf of himself and the people of this time. Do you think his description of people living through history and being incapable of comprehending their own time is accurate? That's a good question, isn't it? I think that old adage, you know, hindsight is 20/20. We can never really see what's happening while it's happening, can we? You can't see the forest for the trees, as they say. I think there's a lot of truth in that. Turtle Vader also asked, is Nikolai going to sleep with that dude's wife? If so, what consequences might he face? It's not the first time in this novel that guys have just completely disregarded a woman's husband and flirted with them directly in front of that husband. Nikolai is doing it here. I don't know. I would like to see some consequence for that, because I see that as a pretty shitty thing to do. Caucus Tree said, were all these women along Nicholas's route to Ferenz actually pleased and flattered that a passing officer should joke with them, or was it clear-cut sexual harassment? It doesn't really seem to be sexual harassment at all. If they seemed pleased and flattered that he's joking with them, I don't really see how you would interpret that as sexual harassment. If they seemed displeased, and he continually, like, harassed them with jokes, then it might border on sexual harassment, or harassment of some nature, but cracking a joke with someone as you're passing through, I don't really see how you could interpret that as sexual harassment. De Fleury said, apparently Nicholas is a cutie pie in his Hussar costume, so... ... Not sure what that implies there, that's so, but, it did seem that, at least in Nicholas's mind, he was a big hit with all the ladies. Whether or not he was, it could be the case that in his mind he's absolutely killing it, you know. Everyone's loving him, but in reality he's just coming across like a kind of an arrogant idiot. Could be entirely possible. But it seems to Nicholas that he is having a bit of luck in that regard. I liked the description of him. It said something along the lines of, like, when you're happy and things are going well, that things tend to keep being easy and keep going well. And he was kind of in that momentum. That's a good place to be, isn't it? When things are going your way and you just feel like you keep going with that momentum and things will keep working out for you. Happy-go-lucky is a good word for it. Good to see Nicholas feeling happy-go-lucky. Alright, I'm going to leave this chapter there. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.